This is Ken Samuelson. I'm in Clemens, North Carolina with Earl Tindall, who's a veteran of World War II. And Earl, if you would, identify yourself and where you live and where you were born.
Okay. I'm Earl Tindall, Jr. I live in Clemens and have for the past 20 years. I was born and raised in Kinston, North Carolina. And went to school at UNC, ended there when I was 16 in 1939.
And what's your date of birth, Earl?
November 2nd, 1922.
Okay.
And stayed at the university for about 2 years. And then we got word that the Navy V-7 program was going to move into Chapel Hill and take all of the available dormitory rooms. And I didn't want to live out in town. So another friend of mine from Kinston convinced me to transfer to the University of Miami in Coral Gables, Florida. So I talked with my parents and we decided we'd give it a try. So I transferred to the University of Miami. My friend who talked me into it did not. Anyhow, I had joined the Enlisted Reserve Corps on September of 1942. And that was designed to let me go through college and then go into the Army. So I was safe until I graduated from college. But at the University of Miami, in Coral Gables and Miami, I'd see all these soldiers and sailors and Marines on the weekend pass, and they seemed to be having one hell of a good time. I said, well, that looks good. Maybe we ought to go in. So I decided I would leave the University of Miami and go into the Army, which I did. I had a nice chat with the president who tried to talk me out of it. And he said, if you're going, and then he told me something I can't tell you. But came home and wrote the Army and told him I was no longer in college and waiting for active duty orders. And I had to call him finally, Third Army, to get him to give me orders. I was told to report to Fort Bragg on a certain date, December 15th, 1942. And was in the process of filling out papers to go into aerial photography, because I had taken a course in photography at Chapel Hill. And I was sitting on the front seat in a row, and this warrant officer came by and asked everybody on the front row, do you want to join the paratroops? No. Do you want to join the paratroops? No. When he got to me, he said, do you want to join the paratroops? No, you couldn't take it. I said, wait a minute here. I don't know about that. So he used good psychology to get me to sign up for the paratroops. Incidentally, after the war, I learned that the warrant officer was the second cousin of mine.
Oh, really?
Anyhow, I was sent to...
Did he know it? Did he know you were sent?
No.
He didn't either. Okay.
No. I was sent to Toccoa, Georgia to take parachute basic. I did not take the regular basic. Went right into taking parachute basic, which the difference was we had a 34-foot tower we had to jump off, simulating a jump. We had a 250-foot tower, which they opened the parachutes and lifted them 250 feet and then dropped you. And so that was the difference in my basic and the regular infantry basic.
Earl, when you went into the service, then you did not take basic training at all, other than the parachute.
That's right.
Paratrooper, I guess, yeah. Training, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So anyway, continue on your training.
Yeah, this went on, and we were to Toccoa, Georgia, and there was a mountain close by called Currahee, and we had to run up that mountain about every week. And it was very tiring, but after we had gotten along so far into the training, it was getting pretty good. until they put in a little bit different place, a thing. We would run up the mountain, get to the top, and previously we had walked down. But this day, we got an order to turn around and walk down the mountains backwards. That was something. Anyhow, I got through that. And incidentally, I was one of 33 men who went from Fort Bragg to Tocoa. Mm-hmm. When I left Tocoa to go to Fort Benning, I was the only one left. And
what happened to the rest of them? They all flunk out or what?
They quit.
They quit?
Yeah.
No kidding.
The parachute basic was something awful.
I guess it was.
I had a little funny incident there. I would throw up every morning after calisthenics and have to go to the infirmary on aid station every morning. And finally one morning I told the captain that was talking to me, he saw me every morning, I said, if you would give me about a 4-hour pass to go into Tocoa and get me a chicken salad sandwich and a chocolate milkshake, I think I could get over this. Well, he finally agreed to it, and yes, I didn't have nausea anymore. But it was just a little thing. Anyhow.
Well, you got a lot of attention then if you were the only man out of 3311.
Yeah.
They were looking down your throat every day, right?
Yeah, I had a little incident happen when I got to Tocoa.
Okay, when you got to Tocoa then, were you saying your Army IQ?
Yeah, I had a high score on my IQ, and I was called a Class 1 recruit.
Uh-huh.
And when we were on the train from Fort Bragg to Tocoa, the head of the captain who was in charge of our group asked me to go into Atlanta while we had a layover, mm-hmm, to help bring some stuff back. And he really took good care of me. So when we got to Tocoa and we got off, and our lieutenant who was in charge, this captain, walked over to him and said, by the way, Tyndall here is a number one recruit. And I said, hey, that's great. So when the captain left, the lieutenant says, I don't care what you are, when you're here, you're just another damn recruit. And we started the worst training I have ever had in my life. It was awful.
Was this advanced paratrooper training then? Or
no.
What was the name of this training then?
Basic parachute training.
Basic parachute training.
And we did the old thing, except we did more. Every morning we would run 6 miles. Well, we got up to that after we had started lower. And then we started running up the mountain. And I was sick one day, and I went on the run, and I had to sit down and rest. Mm-hmm. And my CO came up and called for a medic. Said, if he's sick, send him back. If he's not sick, send him out. Fortunately, I had a temperature. Mm-hmm. So we got through that phase, and then we went to Fort Benning to start paratroop training. Actually,
let me digress back a second to your training. What was the day like? I mean, were you going 10 hours a day, or what was your training like? What time did you get up in the morning?
We got up in the morning at 5:30.
Uh-huh. And then had something to eat, I assume?
No, I had calisthenics first.
Calisthenics first?
Yeah. Then we had something to eat, and then I wasn't used to Army food.
Uh-huh.
And like I say, I went through that nausea problem.
Right.
Anyhow, we got ready to leave Tocoa. We took the train, went to Fort Benning, and we were marching from the train to our barracks. As I said, I was sick. I was just weaving along there, and the captain was giving me hell all the time, straighten up, because we were marching at attention. And we got to the DOQ, I mean not to the DOQ, but the barracks, and I flopped on the first bed I got into. And this captain came up and said, "What in the hell is wrong with you?" I said, "I don't feel good." So he called for the medics. I had a temperature of 103. So they put me in the hospital. And I stayed there for 2 weeks. And by that time, my company had already gone through 2 weeks of parachute basic, consists of 4 weeks. So I was behind everybody. After the end of 2 weeks, I went back to a new unit and we started the basic at the parachute school. The worst thing that I had was that jumping off the 36-foot tower. You were attached to a rope or a line, and you jumped out, and you had on a parachute, not a parachute, but similar to a parachute with a line above it, and that would catch on you. And then you would roll down it, you'd hit a sawdust pile. As soon as you got up, a sergeant says, "Start putting that sawdust back." And we did that for a while, and we went to the 250-foot tower. We got, I went through that, but not too bad.
You did the same, basically the same thing from a 250-foot tower that you did from the 36-foot tower.
So we got down. Then we went on the landing trainer, which was a sloping incline in which you would get on the top, you'd go down, and all of a sudden what you were being held up by was unattached. And you had to hit the ground and hopefully do a parachute fall. And at that time, they were telling you when you hit the ground, go forward and tumble. I did that once, and I didn't like it. From then on, I said, "Well, the best thing for me to do is figure out a new way." So I figured out that how I could hit on my rear end and do a lot better, which I did. I learned one thing: you don't put your canteen on the side that you're going to drop on top. Anyhow, from there, we went into the, well, we didn't have to go through the first phase, because the first phase in parachute school was all calisthenics. And we had been through that at Tocoa, probably more so. But the second week was the towers. And the third week was simulating jumps, going out the mock mill and so forth. And the fourth week was our jumps. We had to make 5 jumps.
An actual parachute jump at that time.
So the first one, I went out and I was so happy I didn't know what to do. And then when I hit on the ground, I said, "Oh my God, we got to do this again." So I did. I went and made my 5 jumps.
And what altitude were you jumping
from? We jumped from 1,600 feet.
1,600 feet.
Yeah. So then I left the company and went back to my old company, which was at Camp McCall, North Carolina, which I loved because it meant if I had a pass on the weekend, I could go home. Anyhow, we stayed at my Camp McCall, and we went on Tennessee maneuvers, made a jump out there. And unfortunately, the jump was a night jump in Tennessee, and the wind was blowing too hard. I couldn't collapse my chute when I got on the ground, and I was drugged about 300 yards. Anyhow, we got through Tennessee maneuvers, went back to Camp McCall, and our commanding officer was a guy named Colonel Johnson. They called him Jumpy Johnson, because every day that he could find a plane, he'd go up and make a jump. He said he did that because he was afraid of jumping, and he wanted to get over that fear. Anyhow, he'd always, after we'd had a day of session, he would speak to us and he'd say, where do we want to go? And everybody say, combat. So we came back from Tennessee maneuvers. We got there and Colonel Johnson said, where do we want to go? And everybody said, furlough.
Have enough of that jumping, huh? Temporarily, anyway.
Yeah, so we got back. And then we were learning to go overseas.
Mm-hmm. What time frame is this now? Do you recall what month it was or whatever?
Yeah, this was in January.
Of 43, then?
43.
Okay.
And we didn't go right yet.
Now, what group were you in? Were you assigned to a particular group then? What was
the 501st Parachute Infantry.
Okay, 501st Parachute Infantry. Yeah.
Which was part of the 101st Airborne.
Okay.
We didn't join the 101st Airborne until we went overseas.
I see.
So when we got overseas, we were assigned, attached to the 101st Airborne.
Mm-hmm. And so where did you go overseas initially? And how did you get there?
We went to Boston and got on a troop ship, the George W. Goethals.
Uh-huh.
And it took us about 14 days to get to England. We docked in Glasgow, Scotland.
What was your trip over like? What was the conditions aboard this vessel that you were on? Was it pretty crowded?
It was very crowded.
What kind of facilities did you have as an individual on this
One
ship?
Cot.
One cot?
A bunk that actually fell down from the wall.
Okay. Did you have a place to store personal things and so forth, or was just...
Put it where you could.
Put it where you could.
So we went over, and the food was okay. But we got into some bad weather. Uh-huh. And they couldn't serve us hot food, so we ate sandwiches for a couple of days. And we finally got over, we docked at Glasgow, Scotland. And then we took a train to Lambourne, England, which is about 60 miles southeast, southwest of London. And we were housed in the King's stables. They had cleaned them up, fortunately. I was in a room with about six people. And in the middle, we had an old pot-bellied stove.
Uh-huh.
And the only thing we had for fuel was Coke. And you try to start a fire with Coke, it's hell. But it's terrible. So we...
Cold weather, too, I take it.
So
you needed some warmth.
Sure did. But we... did a lot of training. Mostly the training was in the field. And we went through several stages of types of combat, a jump, of course, and then defensive positions and offensive positions and several other things.
Did you go into hand-to-hand combat and this kind of thing,
Or
had you already done that?
We had done that before, but we did it again.
Uh-huh.
And we had bayonet drills.
Mm-hmm.
And mostly it was operational.
Mm-hmm.
I have a picture of my unit. And down below it, it says the 501st Parachute Infantry somewhere in England.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we couldn't tell where we were.
Let me ask you a quick question about the King's Stables. Now, when you say the King's Stables, were you located near a residence then of the King, I take it?
No, not the residence, but...
A residence, you know, the one of the...
Yeah.
So you were literally on the King's grounds, you might say. Huh?
Right.
That's an interesting point. And had they taken the stalls out of these stables then and turned it into living quarters, basically?
They did a pretty good job.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The only thing that I didn't like was the toilet facilities.
Mm-hmm.
They were not good at all.
Yeah.
And I didn't like to take a shower with 10 other people.
Yeah. That sounds like my Navy days.
Then we kept doing our training there. And around the middle of May, we were alerted.
This is 43 now? Or what?
44.
44 now, okay. Yeah. So you were there quite a while then, I take it, huh?
Yeah. And we were sent to the marshalling area in southwestern France. Mm-hmm. I mean, southwestern England, which is right on the coast. Mm-hmm. And
now you were, at this point, you had been assigned to as part of the 101st Airborne Division?
Yes.
When you went overseas, I take it.
And we went to the marshalling area. Nobody could go in, nobody could go out. And one day we saw, it's an interesting sidelight, two MPs come into the marshalling area, went and got one of our soldiers and took him away. I've never found out why he was taken away. I've often wondered about that. So then we were alerted. We got a briefing from the officers at a sand table showing us the lay of the land where we were supposed to jump. And then the night before we jumped, we were supposed to take off at 11 o'clock at night.
So you went there in May, and you were there approximately a month, would you say?
Well, no, about 2 weeks.
About 2 weeks. Yeah. What did you know about what you were doing? You must have had some inkling of what the purpose of all this was.
Well, we figured we'd jump somewhere in France, but uh-huh. We didn't know where.
But you had very little information as to any specifics?
Not until we got the final briefing.
Okay, and the final briefing was what day, working back from June the 6th?
It was on the second day before we jumped.
Okay, so June the 4th, you got a final briefing.
Yeah.
And at that point, what was your briefing like? How many were there? Who was briefing you?
There was a major who had a sand table. Mm-hmm. And he briefed us on where we'd be jumping.
Now, how many people was he talking to at that time? Was just your group or?
It was about, it was a smaller group than normal because everybody had to see the sand table. Uh-huh. I guess it was 30 or 40.
So there were a lot of briefings like that, I take it, right. Then. This was your individual briefing.
Right. So when we got ready to go, well, we didn't know it yet, but the night before, like I say, we jumped at 11 o'clock. We took off at 11 o'clock at night. Mm-hmm. At the supper table that night. We had steak, fried chicken, pork chops, and we knew this was it.
Here's your question. At the briefing, do you recall, of course, you had the sand table there, so he told you kind of the terrain that you would be jumping into. What else did he tell you about what you were supposed to do after you landed?
We were supposed to take a lock, the barquette locks, which held back the swamp water. Mm-hmm. Because if they had been able to open those locks, our jump area would have been flooded. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, our people landed right near the locks and had it taken.
Now, these locks were located where? Is this near Utah Beach, Omaha Beach, or what would have been
Utah
there?
Utah Beach.
It was near Utah Beach,
yeah.
Okay. Was there a town near that you could kind of pinpoint this, or was it kind of out in the country somewhere?
It was out in the country.
Okay. So he told you what you had to do. Did he give you any additional instructions on how you were to do it and what you're to do? Maybe you could.
There were four causeways that came from the ocean through the swamp to dry land. Mm-hmm. And we didn't want them to flood it. So our mission was to get behind those beach and clear out the enemy. Mm-hmm. And then they marched in.
Of course, this was before D-Day.
This was the morning of D-Day.
So you were to drop the morning of D-Day, okay.
1:10 in the morning.
Okay, 1:10, literally 1 a.m., huh?
Yeah.
Okay. And that was probably six hours or so, 4 or 5 hours before the actual landing that I took.
Yeah.
Something like that.
So we took off from England at 11 o'clock.
What type of aircraft were you in?
C-47.
Okay.
And of course we had to rendezvous with 600 other planes. So we didn't jump to 1:10. So we were in the plane from 11 o'clock till 1:10 in the morning. And those bucket seats can get mighty hard on your rear end.
Yes. How many other squads or whatever had the same assignment you did? Or were you the only one that had that particular assignment?
We had one causeway and another group had another one.
Okay, so there were several kind of doing the same thing.
Right. Then, okay. So at 1:10, we jumped. Before we jumped, as we went across to the coast of the Normandy Peninsula,
yeah.
I looked over there and I saw the most beautiful sight I'd ever seen in my life. It looked like 5,000 Christmas trees. That's where the anti-aircraft called up.
Not very pleasant Christmas trees.
No, and our pilot got scared of that and turned off to the right.
Really?
Which he eventually gave us the red light, stand up and hook up, and the green light, jump.
But he had corrected and come back to the proper, no?
No, unfortunately not. So when we landed and we jumped from 300 feet, it was almost like walking out the door and start walking on the ground.
Well, how much time did you have for your parachute to open then? Just a second you had to.
It wasn't much.
So you were attached to a static line, I take it, and could they adjust the speed with which your parachute would open based on that, or did it just open automatically as you jumped?
Yeah. So we landed. Incidentally, we used old dime store crickets for our sine and cosine.
Mm-hmm.
You thought you heard somebody click a cricket. And if somebody heard you, they'd click it twice to say they heard you.
Let's stop right here just a second then. Okay, you're about to jump out of the plane. Tell me what equipment you had with you when you jumped. How were you dressed? What did you have with you?
We had on jumpsuits, which were different from the...
Like a one-piece suit?
Two-piece
suit.
And they had baggy pockets, so you could put 4 or 5 K rations in one of the pockets.
Uh-huh.
And had a little pocket up here for your jump knife.
Uh-huh. And what's a jump knife?
That's a very strong, look like a pocket knife, except a little bigger. And you needed that occasionally. If you couldn't get out of your chute, you had to cut your way out.
I see.
When we jumped, I had to cut my way out. I could not get this straps on me. So I cut my way out, got my chute collapsed.
Okay, what else did you carry then?
I had clothes.
Wait, you had clothes? In other words, you're going to take off your jump shoes? Is that the idea?
No, another jumpsuit.
Oh, you had another?
Yeah.
Okay.
And underwear.
Uh-huh.
And toilet articles. And anything that you might want to carry with you.
What kind of weapon did you carry?
I was had a carbine.
Okay, you had an M1 carbine.
Yes.
I have one at home. very handy.
And we had a carrier for it.
Mm-hmm. You had it slung over your back?
No, it was attached to the jump.
Oh, okay. So it couldn't fall loose as you jumped. It was securely fashioned. Okay.
No.
Had a knife, combat knife?
Yes. We had that on our boot.
Okay.
Attached to the boot.
Attached to the boot.
Yeah.
Was there a place on your boot that was sewn into the boot, or was it just attached to it?
We just attached it ourselves.
Okay. So you had jump boots, I take it then?
Yes.
And they lace up to mid-calf or something?
about a quarter calf.
Quarter calf.
Yeah.
Very heavy, I take it.
They are heavy, but they're one of the most comfortable footwear I've ever put on. I still have a jump boot upstairs.
Is that right? What did you wear on your head?
Helmets.
You had a helmet, steel helmet?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And how much ammunition did you carry?
We had clips. I went all the way around us, so I guess probably a couple hundred rounds.
Okay.
Something like that.
So you were heavy?
Yes.
You were heavy.
Plus, they gave us a choice to jump with a landmine or a battery for a 300 radio. And I figured the landmine might have a problem, so I jumped with a radio battery.
You didn't want that landmine to go off.
No.
That's interesting. Okay, so you're jumping from 300 feet. Yeah. You had the parachute had open immediately, otherwise you were in big trouble. Did many of your fellow soldiers have a problem with their chutes opening or anything, do you know? Or
not that I know of.
But most of them survived, as far as you recollect.
Yeah.
Okay, so you were jumping then into an area that was really not the exact area you were supposed to jump into.
I landed 15 miles from where I was supposed to land.
How did you even know where you were?
I didn't. I had no idea. Couldn't find a soul.
Now, when you landed, were any of your fellow soldiers near you?
I didn't see any.
Didn't see any. So you came down by yourself. And what were your feelings at that time, Earl?
My feelings when I got up and looked. Of course, I didn't stand up.
Yeah.
I got on my haunches and looked. I thought, what in the hell is going on? Where are all my people? And finally, I got a click.
Oh.
And I answered it. And it was not a close friend, but a friend of mine named Bob Wickham from Wisconsin. And we sat there and was trying to decide what to do, as we didn't know where we were. We were supposed to go to a place that had a spotlight, a light, a red light.
That the underground had lit for you, or what?
No, our advanced Pathfinder units.
Oh, there was somebody that came in before you then that was supposed to have a light to guide you then.
Right.
Okay.
Well, anyhow, I didn't see a red light. I didn't see anything. I didn't hear anything. And just
no guns going off, nothing?
No. And I got a click.
Right.
I answered it, and it was like this guy I told you, Bob Wickham. So we were sitting there trying to figure out what to do since we didn't see a red light, and we heard a click. And we answered it, and it was Captain Chastet, who was our operations officer for the battalion. So, of course, then he took over, and we started on our haunches.
Just the three of you?
Just the three of us. We were going to where we thought the point was, where we were supposed to meet.
Where the red light was supposed to be, anyway.
And we got up and couldn't find it. And we got to a hedgerow. There are hedgerows all over Normandy. And we were crossing a road. Captain Chastet went first, then Wickham, and then me. And as I got in the middle of the road, I saw somebody out to my right side, and this person said, "Soldaten." Well, I think I broke the record for the 100-yard dash.
Soldaten, what is it?
German for soldier.
Soldier, yeah, sort of thing.
So we got to the edge of the back part of a hedgerow, where the hedgerows come together, and we were there. And all of a sudden, we heard a big noise, I guess about 50 yards up the hedgerow. And Captain Chastet says, "Y'all stay here. If I'm not back in 10 minutes, come after me." We stayed there and we heard a big commotion. So we decided to go on up there. We got there, everybody was gone. So we crossed over the hedgerow.
So your captain was not there?
No. And he was killed eventually, we learned. We crossed over the hedgerow, and there was a German bivouac area. But fortunately, they were all out looking for us.
And you were there.
So we skirted the edge, went across the field, and came to a ditch that went under the road, the culvert. Mm-hmm. So we decided we'd get under there, because it wasn't raining and there was no water coming through it. Mm-hmm. And we spent the night there.
Virtually right next to the German bivouac area, huh?
Yeah. And they marched right all over us on the road.
They were marching over the road, and yeah. You were underneath.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
And at one time, two Germans set up a mortar about 25 yards from us in the field. And my friend Bob says, I'm going to go put a grenade down that tube. And I said, you do, I'll kill you, Bob. But anyhow, they finally moved on. And we stayed in the culvert for 2 days. And then our rations were running out. And there was a farmhouse, I guess, 50 yards from where we were. So I said, let's go up here. So he was there. But we went down the road, down the ditch, and there's another ditch that went behind the house. So we used the ditch all the way and got to the house. And Bob and I walked into the house, and the two French couple, they looked up at us, and like they thought they'd seen the devil. And then I said, "Nous sommes soldats américains." And then they came over and hugged and kissed us and did all this sort of stuff.
Did they give you that phrase before you took off?
No, I just knew that.
You just knew
that. I took 4 years of French.
Okay, that was fortunate.
Yeah.
So you identified yourself as Americans, and then were they frightened or happy to see you? Okay, you're real happy to see you. All right.
Yeah. And I got out. I had three maps on the area where we might be going. Mm-hmm. And I took out the first map, and the man said, no. Second, no. Third one, no. I said, where the heck are we? And he said, Rougeville.
Rougeville.
Yeah. And then they called a meeting of the people there, what, maybe 30 people probably.
30 French people?
Yeah.
Okay. Came together and...
And they decided what to do with me and Bob. So they took us up to a wheat field, which is on the side of a hill. And we stomped out a place for us to sit and sleep. And we could watch the Germans going by on the road down the hill from us. Mm-hmm. And when we first walked into this house, they had a beef roast cooking over an open fire with a pot hanging from the rod. And that smelled the best I'd ever smelled in my life. So they started bringing us milk, and I don't know, I guess I drank about 3 quarts of milk a day.
How long were we there with them?
I was there for 2 days.
Okay.
And the second day they brought us some of that beef. That was the best taste of beef I ever had in my life. So.
Now, were the Germans searching at this time they must have been searching for people like you.
Yeah, they were.
Did they come near that farmhouse, or did you feel like they might find you there?
Well, we saw them marching down on the road down the bottom of the hill.
But they didn't have scouts out looking that you could see.
Not.
Yeah. So you felt fairly secure there in that farmhouse, temporarily.
So the second day, some Frenchman came up and handed me a note. And it's told about the group of Americans at a place called Grania's. And he said, the French will lead you here at night. Signed, Mern. And I almost jumped in joy because Lieutenant Mern was one of our officers.
Oh, okay.
So that night,
Wait a minute, how did that note get there then?
A freshman brought it.
Okay. But how did Mern know that?
They told him.
Oh, they told him you were there, okay, and they gave him your name, I guess, okay.
Well, that night we started, two French people came, started taking us through the woods. Mm-hmm. And we'd stop at a house in the back, in the woods, back of a house. And the man would come running out with a bottle of brandy. Said he'd been saving it for the Americans. So I had to drink some brandy. We went to the next house. Same thing, man brought out his brandy. And drank, went to the third house, same thing. But then we had to cross about 1,000 yards over a swamp. And we started walking. And we had a Frenchman in front of us.
Now you were going where this Lieutenant Mern said you were supposed to go. So right. You were just following orders at that point. Huh?
So we had a Frenchman in front of us and the Frenchman's about 50 yards behind us. Mm-hmm. And we got about halfway across the culvert, the bridge. And the one behind us started yelling, "La Bosch," German.
Yeah, right.
So we took off running. And all that brandy in my running created a problem. Well, I stopped and threw up right in the middle of it. Then I started running again. And we went to a French farmhouse. It was just at the end of the bridge.
So the Germans didn't actually see you then, I'm taking it?
No. Okay. And we got in there, and I thought, good, we're safe. And the lady of the house wanted us to spend the night. I thought, hey, that's great. But this one gentleman who spoke perfect English said, no, you can't spend the night. You've got to go to Grinius. But you can't go in at night because they'll think you're Germans. So we went through ditches and they gave us a bottle of brandy before we left.
Plenty of brandy, right?
Yeah. So we were walking down the ditch, had a couple of snorts of brandy. And I said, Bob, let's get out on this road. It'd be easier walking. So we got out on the road and started walking towards Grinius. And we knew when we got close to Grinius, so we stopped and spent the night. Rest of the night. And the next morning we walked into Grinius. I thought, hey, safe at last. Then they told us that we were still surrounded. That we were,
that was, you had gone through German lines, I guess, to get to Grinius, huh?
Yeah. Well, no, well, yes.
Because they were surrounded, surrounded, so obviously you had to go through.
But the French people knew how to get around it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, did you... It took a lot of courage to go out and walk on that road, I'd say, because you were, of course, it was, what time of day was this then? Was this at night?
This was at night.
Okay, so nobody could see you particularly.
Well, we had a couple of drinks of brandy. You're
called courageous, huh?
Let's get out of this bitch.
Turn tape now.
This is an editor's note. End of tape A, side one. The interview continues on tape A, side two.
Okay, you said let's get out of this ditch. Incidentally, of course, your original assignment of going to the dive, that's all out the window now because that was hopeless. Everything had already happened.
Yeah.
So you were just trying to get back to your group, I guess, basically.
Yeah. But we got the Grinius. And found out we were still surrounded. Mm-hmm. So,
were there any other U.S. soldiers in?
There was people from the 101st Airborne, from the 82nd Airborne, two Australian pilots who had to bail out of the plane, and
all of you basically lost. I guess had been lost and kind of grouping up again.
And we had a scout from the 28th Infantry that got lost.
Scouted got lost. Oh boy.
So then we went into a defensive position. I dug my foxhole. and about 2 days later.
Now, when you were in Grania, you dug a foxhole. This is on the outskirts of Grania's? Okay, so you were in a defensive position trying to, you and all the other people there, set up a defensive position. How many would you say people like yourself were there?
Probably 50.
50? So the 50 of you, did you have a person who took over as commander of the group then?
Yeah, Captain Bogart, who was in my regiment.
Okay, so Captain Bogart said we're going to set up a defensive position in Grania's to protect really just yourselves because you weren't protecting, you couldn't protect the town. Okay.
And one day, two Germans on motorcycles came into the middle part of Grania. And they fired on them. They killed one of them, but the other one got away. Mm. And that's when the Germans started pouring on us. Artillery, mortar, a little bit of everything.
So they knew you were there. Up to that time, I guess they had no idea that there were any Americans or allies in there.
Then a runner came by and said, Captain Bogart wants to see all of you at the headquarters.
So he had set up a little headquarters spot in one of the houses?
It was a big church, and it was at the basement.
Okay.
So we were in it, and damn it, I left my musette bag with everything I owned at my foxhole. And we got there, and Captain Bogart told us the problem, the situation, and said, get out the best way you can. So that created a problem. But again, the Frenchman came to our rescue.
Now, he said, get out the best way you can because he knew that you'd be overrun.
Yeah.
Is that the idea?
Yeah.
So he's saying just every man for himself.
Right.
Okay.
Well, this Frenchman, there was a swamp. Big swamp right next to Grania's. So we started out, the Frenchman was leading us, marching through the swamp. And it was about waist high. Mm-hmm. And so I took my cigarettes out of my pocket and put them in the helmet. Smart. And we went through that swamp for probably an hour. And we came onto a house, the Frenchman apparently knew where it was. It was a deserted house. Nobody lived in it. There was a bunch of straw and a big back room. So we went in there, and there were about six or seven others there. Oh, good idea. Got me a cigarette in it. I got my cigarette out. I left my lighter in my pocket. I didn't have a cigarette. Anyhow,
did you ever get your musette bag?
No.
Never did get that.
Never did. And it had a picture of my fiance in it. Mm-hmm. And some food, of course. Toilet articles, stuff of that nature. Anyhow, we got to this deserted house, and the Frenchman took us there, left and said, I'll be back tomorrow. Well, he came the next day and told us to come on, we're going somewhere else. So we went to a little place right beside a canal, and they put us up in a attic of a garage. And I guess there were about 20, 25 of us there. Not all, about 20. And the lady brought us some potato soup. And that was the best potato soup I had had in my life. Because I hadn't had anything to eat. Anyhow, we stayed there a couple of days.
Now, did you have a leader at this point, commander, just a bunch of enlisted men who were there together trying to figure out the best thing to do.
Huh? Yeah.
And was your goal, I assume, at that point, was to get back to your group, right? You're still trying to get back to your group. Okay.
Well, we stayed there a couple of days, and the lady fed us what she could. And one day she came up there and hollering, her husband was sick, terrible. And I said, well, I'll go look at him. Well, then he was having problems. He told me what his problems were. And I said, that's going to be a kidney problem. So I had a bunch of sulfur pills. Mm. So I gave them to him. I told him to take one in the morning, one at night. But apparently I didn't get across. He took every one of them. Well, the next day the lady came up there all hope flustered and said, oh, come. So I went down and he was well. He was feeling good.
That massive dose worked, huh?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Then the French got a tugboat and brought it up the canal. Mm-hmm. And we all got in the back of the tugboat and they covered us up with a tarp. Mm-hmm. And we took off, chug, mm-hmm. up the canal. Right through German lines. And I learned.
Nobody stopped here?
No.
Nothing.
No, because I guess they did that all the time.
Uh-huh.
But incidentally, I went within 250 yards of my brother-in-law. Mm. When he found out after the war where I'd been, and also he was a company commander and he was on his CP.
Mm.
So we got to Carentan and got out, and I found where my company headquarters was. So I walked in, and there was Captain Howard, who had succeeded Captain Simmons because he was captured. And Lieutenant Howard said, Tyndall, where in the hell have you been? I said, sir, if I told you, you wouldn't believe me. Then I got back in the routine, of course, and then we started.
And this is D-Day plus what?
D-Day plus 12.
Plus 12, okay, so the 18th June, roughly. So you were wandering the French countryside for 12 days trying to get back to your group, all because of a bad drop.
Yep.
There was a lot of that, I know. Yep. A lot of bad drops.
Yeah, unfortunately, one plane loaded dropped them over the sea.
So one drop you can recall, they dropped a group of men into the sea, which was a real tragedy. So we spent about 12 days now trying to find your way back and kind of go on from there, I guess.
Okay, yes, like I told you, I reported to the captain. He wanted to know where the hell I was. But then we started an offensive because the 28th Infantry Division was almost decimated at Omaha Beach. They didn't have a paratroop unit jumped behind their line because their CO did not want paratroop units behind their line. But so we were in combat for 33 days. Initially we were supposed to be there 72 hours. So we completed 33 days and we went back to England and started training for our next mission. And the next mission was not going to be a spur of the moment thing, because we were supposed to jump in Holland. And get control of the road from Eindhoven to Arnhem, which is about 50 miles. So the night before we were called to go to the marshalling area.
Did you have any special training for this, Earl? Anything special happened to you, just more of the usual training?
Yeah. The only thing different was we got Dutch money.
Ah, okay.
So anyhow, we took off. This was a daylight job.
And do you recall the day?
September 17th, okay. 1944. And we were jumping so far behind German lines, 50 miles, that it was sort of like parade ground jump. There was no opposition, there was no flag, except when we went through Belgium. But we jumped from 800 feet this time, which gave us a lot more leeway.
Now, how many were in your group this time?
In the plane?
Yeah, well, how many planes and so forth? The number of men that took part in this jump?
This invasion was the largest airborne invasion ever.
Oh, okay.
Because we had 82nd, 101st, 17th Airborne, 36th Airborne and the Canadian.
Yeah. So this was what you would call a major offensive move into Holland.
The idea was to go up the road through Holland into Germany from the back door.
I see.
But we had a little problem there. Anyhow, we jumped. Saved the parade ground jump. We were marching into Beckel. And some little gal, about 10 years old, came up to me and gave me an ice cream sandwich. And we got to Beckel. And nothing going on for a little while. But then we started getting attacks from Germans.
I mean, they weren't sitting still there. They knew what was happening. So they had to counteract your offensive move.
And the one thing that I learned is even though you're on an offensive, from the British viewpoint, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, you stop and have your tea. And that's what happened. And we were supposed to control the road so the British could come up the road through Arnhem and into Germany. But the British are not quite as aggressive as the Americans. If somebody shot at them, just a single sniper, they'd stop. And as a result, it was a long time before they got up to Arnhem, where they were supposed to go into Germany. And by that time, the German forces had gotten up there and destroyed the bridge so that we couldn't get in that way. So it's all.
Can you just stop a second? You mentioned that the British stopped for tea. Now, I'm assuming you're serious when you say that.
I'm very serious.
And they're in the middle of a march, and they just stopped.
That's right.
And they had somebody prepare tea, and these guys were sipping tea on the side of the road. Unbelievable.
Now, the only good thing about being with the British, we were actually under British control, was that
Montgomery, or who?
Yes. Well, not him directly, but he was over.
He was the top.
Yeah. Was that every Thursday night we got a rum ration. And there was 2 ounces of rum grog, and you mix it with 2 ounces of water, so you get 4 ounces of rum. And if you got a friend like I did, John Holland, who didn't drink, I had a good ration on every Thursday night. Anyhow, the British finally came through, and we were sent home back to England to prepare for our next mission. And we went to France this time. We had cleared out France. And December 16th, I think it was.
Can I digress a second? Now, this big offensive now, what was the final result of that? You said you were pulled out. What was the final result of this mission into Holland?
It was zero because the British 6th Airborne couldn't take Arnhem.
Okay. So they had to pull you out then at that point? So would you say that this offensive action then was unsuccessful?
Mm-hmm.
Unsuccessful. And it was a big commitment, but it wound up being unsuccessful. How did you get out?
We marched down. And trucks and so forth.
But weren't the Germans in your path? How did you?
No, we had pushed them all up there by that time.
Oh, so you had a clear path back to the channel, in other words, huh? So
yeah,
you could march back to the channel.
An amazing thing was that at the upper part of our line, there was a dike, and they were keeping it from the Niederrhein River.
Mm-hmm.
And we kept wondering what was going to happen if they decided to blow the dock.
Yeah, you drown.
Yeah. But we got out, and 2 days after we left, they blew the dock. Well, in the whole area. Don't happen after we went back to France.
Now, how did they pick you up? By boat, I take it?
No.
To go back across the channel?
We didn't go back to England, we went back to France.
Oh, you went back to France.
Yeah.
Okay, at that point we captured enough in France where you could do your training and so forth.
Right. So we got furloughed to Paris, which was a wonderful weekend. And we're sitting in France, just waiting for another mission. And the Germans started marching in the Battle of the Bulge towards Bastogne. So we were called up immediately to go to Bastogne. We got up there, and the commanding general at that time was General McAuliffe, because our regular commander was in the U.S. So,
we was your group in Bastogne at that point? Did you say?
No. Maybe we're not there. No. We got called up there. We got there before the Germans did. Uh-huh. And I remember what our regimental commander told that battalion commander, go out this road and develop the situation. And I got out there, and this is the first time the Germans had made any resistance in there.
A big offensive in the Battle of Warsaw.
And so they pushed us back and started, they couldn't get through, so they started going around us. They needed Bastogne because that was when all the roads came together. Mm-hmm. And they had to get it because they'd have to go through the countryside. But they got around us, captured our hospital, which was about 10 miles from Bastogne. And as one of our boys said, they got us surrounded, the poor bastards.
Kind of right where we want to buy.
Well, paratroopers were always around. That's what we were, how we were taught to fight.
Yeah.
And when we were in Bastogne, we had a tank destroyer battalion that was in there with us. And another small unit.
So you eventually wound up in Bastogne?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Called up to go to Bastogne.
Totally surrounded, of course.
Yeah. And we got a pretty good shellacking from them at night. We had what we always called Dead Shake Charlie. He come over to bomb us. But you knew he was coming at 10 o'clock, you could go take steps. And I was...
What steps did you take? What did you do?
Go down in the cellar or something like that. And I was in supply at that time. We had our headquarters in a building that had been vacated when the Germans came in that way. And very fortunately, in the cellar of this building was a wine cellar. So we had a good time. But we stayed there, and they had one time 10 divisions trying to get past on. That's when they sent the message to General McAuliffe, and he had some nuts, which we thought was a good answer. And we stayed there until General Patton came up from the south and relieved us. But then we went down through southern France, through northern France, fighting, because it was one unit that could not cross the canal that they were next to. They'd go over there and they'd get pushed back. They'd go over there and get pushed back. So we went down there and we went over there and held it.
Which canal is this one?
It's the one in northern France.
Okay.
I can't remember.
Yeah.
But we told the British, if you can't hold it, don't do it. But they finally, we took 10 miles. We figured that'd be enough to give the British a chance. And then we started going south from there to place where they'd have a little problem.
You digress a second back to Bastogne. How long were you in Bastogne under these conditions when the Germans were shelling you? And, you weren't able to do anything offensively, I wouldn't guess. You're just in defensive
10 days.
Mode. 10 days they were shelling you.
They started on December 16th and it ended the day after Christmas.
And how did it end? It just stopped? Did they retreat? What?
No. Like I say, General Patton was coming up from
right now. So he relieved the pressure, I guess.
Yeah, and it had been cloudy for the whole time, and our Air Force couldn't get up. And the day after Christmas, they could get up. So they started destroying the enemy tanks.
Okay.
And everything else that they could get in their sights.
Right.
And then we got resupplied as soon as the weather broke. And we got ammunition, food, stuff like that.
So you started driving with Patton, and then your resupply, you started just driving the Germans back at that point. Were you in a situation where you were firing your weapon, or you what was your situation? You said, I think you were in the supply area at that point.
I had to fire my weapon occasionally, because when we took supplies up to the front lines, we'd get
a little fire.
Yeah. And the funny thing, we had put, somebody had put a bunch of landmines on the road that they would take to come in. But they're pretty smart. They got a herd of cattle and drove it through there.
Had a lot of roast beef, I
guess. Yeah. Anyhow, General Patton came up from the south and took some pressure off of us. And then we went into northern France to help another unit.
Mm-hmm.
Then we went back to France. And that was our last combat mission. Well, we stayed there until the war was over. I was in Erdning, Austria, on occupation duty. And
when the war was over, you think? They had sent you from France into Austria, I think.
Okay. And at that time, you had to accumulate a certain number of points before you could go home.
Yeah.
And I remember one guy in our unit got a letter from his wife. Said, damn it, she's pregnant. He said, oh, hell, that means I can go home and get 5 more points. So he was happy.
Good news and bad news, I think.
Yeah.
So you were, they sent you from France to Austria. Now, of course, getting to Austria, this was, were you sent to Austria after the war was over, or before the war? Okay. So the, what company were you in the 101st?
I had been, after the war was over, I disbanded my unit, and I went to F Company, 502nd Parachute Infantry.
Okay. I remember in that Band of Brothers, Easy Company, I think, was the company they wrote up in, I don't know if you read Band of Brothers, book about the 101st Airborne. It's quite a good story about that group of men. So you were in Austria doing, tell me the nature of your duty in Austria. What the occupation duty, what did that involve?
Factory, I think. The people in Austria was all for us.
Uh-huh. How did you learn about the end of the war? How did you learn about victory in Europe, anyway?
We were in Auxerre, France, after we left Austria.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was in Japanese war, I heard about this. Oh, let's see.
D-Day,
you know. We were in, or close to Rheims, France, mm-hmm. as they call it, last. And we got word that the Germans and Americans were meeting in Rheims. And the day after that, we got word that the war was over.
Mm-hmm.
That the Germans had surrendered. And Hitler was dead. So we celebrated, and then we got ready to go to Japan, and we thought we'd have to.
Right.
There was a little bit different type of training. Some of them decided.
Did you feel like you were going to actually go to Japan?
Yeah.
I mean, basically what you've been told and so forth?
Yeah.
What changed that? Do you have any idea why you didn't actually go to Japan?
That's when they dropped the atom bomb.
Okay, so that was all happening then, and the atom bomb was dropped.
Yeah, I remember we were in our room, and it was about the afternoon, I don't remember the date, and somebody had the radio on, and it came up and said that the Americans had dropped an atomic bomb in Japan. And we went, what the hell is an atomic bomb? Well, we found out later. Yeah.
What medals did you receive, Earl, when you, for sake of record?
Well, I had, of course, the American Theater Ribbon, European Theater Ribbon. The European River Theater had an Arrowhead and four stars. The Arrowhead, an initial invasion, and four stars are full battles. And I have a Bronze Star, Good Conduct Medal, and a couple of more I can't remember.
If you can recollect a particular moment that might be one of your most memorable experiences, other than maybe the learning of the end of the war, what would you say would be your most memorable experience of all this time and
the 12 days behind Germany?
Now, what happened here at home? What kind of news did your folks get? Any news of you?
No, I sent them a letter telling them that I probably wouldn't be able to write to them for a while. I couldn't tell them all.
Right.
And
this was prior to the June drop.
Yeah.
Prior to June, so.
And of course, I couldn't get any mail for a while.
Right.
And I have a letter upstairs I wrote to my mother saying, today I got the first mail in 2 weeks and I got 3 letters from you. And in this letter I wrote, I said, this is after all was over. And more Belgium. And I thought, well, that was the best place I've been, more like the United States. I said, tonight, we went out and had fried chicken for supper. At about 9 o'clock, we decided we'd have steak. So we had a steak. And then about midnight, we had another steak. And in Belgium, they had street vendors for fried potatoes. Mm-hmm. And they were the best fried potatoes I've ever eaten in my life.
You were a hungry guy. Yeah, for sure. Well, did your parents get any word of you at all during those 12 days?
No. They got a letter from a telegram from the
War Department or whatever.
Yeah.
And what did it say?
That I've been missing in action since June 8th. Uh-huh. And they would let me know.
They would let them know if they heard any word.
Yeah.
And did they finally correct that and give a telegram that you had been found?
Yes.
Or how did they learn about the fact that you were still alive?
I sent them a telegram.
You sent them a telegram?
I got back to England. Yes, because my brother-in-law had sent his chaplain over to find me and see if I was all right.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to him. He told me that my parents had been given the message I was missing in action.
Mm-hmm.
So I went and sent a telegram, definitely not missing action.
You weren't missing any action, that's for sure. How long a period of time after their telegram saying you were missing in action were you able to communicate with them?
It was about 7 or 8 days.
So they had 7 or 8 days in when they were very, very worried.
Yeah, my daddy said he wasn't going to work anymore.
Yeah,
I'm not going to work for him.
I can believe that.
And then we came back to the States. And
how many points? When did you come back to the States? I mean, you had to have so many points.
Yeah.
In
I got back November 17th.
Okay, so that was quite a while.
Yeah. And
now, was this based on the number of points you had, yeah, or were they, at that point, they were kind of letting everybody?
No, the points, still
points. Points.
When I got to Fort Bragg, I said, yeah, I'm 90 miles from home, I'm going home. So I took off, went AWOL, caught a bus to Kinsley. And when the bus came in, the Kinsley came in from the south. And our main street ran north and south. I asked the bus driver, I said, would you put me off here so I can walk through downtown? I hadn't been through it in 3 years. He said, so I walked home, but somebody, friend of ours, saw me and moved me out. And my mother came up, and I was going out on the front porch so she wouldn't see me. They come in. Well, she decided to come in the front way. And she walked out, hi, Mom. Anyhow, I had to get back the next morning. So my mother let me use her car, and Daddy siphoned some gas out of his pickup. And he had three, something like that, last day. So I got back to Fort Bragg, went to where
I was. You were AWOL, right?
Yeah.
So what did they do?
Well, they were calling out names when to go to discharge. And I had been back and forth like about 5 minutes and my name was called.
So they never knew that you were gone? Did they even know that you were, had been AWOL?
No.
So it just worked out that you were there at the right time.
That's right.
Answered the roll call, and so you didn't get caught.
And the funny thing happened the first Christmas that I was in the Army. I went in December 15th. Like a stupid fool, I went to First Sergeant and said, how about give me a pass to go home for Christmas? He said, go over the hill like everybody else is going to do. I said, over the hill? I looked out there. I don't see no hill. I didn't know what it meant the first day.
Did you, during your time in Europe, did you ever come face to face with the enemy?
Not directly. I well, at one place in Grandes, France, where that's what caused our downfall, was start giving to the Germans. Just for 3 or 4 days we didn't have any activity. And that's when I got rid of my carbine. Because I saw a German soldier, and I hit him in the butt, and he fell down. He got up, went a little further, I hit him, he fell down. He got up, went a little further, I hit him again, he fell down. And last time I saw him, he was running away. That's when I said, the hell with carbine. I want something to kill.
Carbine didn't work too well. I know it's not a very accurate gun, except at very close range, I guess you can hit something, but not at any distance. I have one. I can speak from some experience in firing my carbine.
You know who invented that, don't you?
Huh?
You know who invented that?
Yeah, a guy from North Carolina.
Carbine Williams.
That's right.
In prison.
Yeah, that's right. There's a movie by him some years ago. James Stewart played the role.
One interesting thing is that when we jumped on D-Day, we were supposed to be there for 72 hours, was all, just to clarify for the infantry to come in.
Yeah, to, for those blocks, I guess, or whatever it was.
And we were there 33 days.
Yeah.
But we got back okay to the end. And at the time, I enjoyed England.
What was the attitude of the English toward the American soldier? If you have any recollection of that?
Yes, they're overpaid, oversexed, and over here.
Yeah, I heard that. So would you say it was kind of a negative reaction on the part of the English? Did you make friends with any particular English people while you were there that took you under your wing or anything? No, not particularly. You kind of stayed with your group and didn't get out into the into the civilian.
Kidding, I ran into a female that I might have gone home with.
What was it like in England while you were there? Now, you would have been there, what, in late 43, I guess?
No.
What would be the time? And then early 44?
I got there in January 44.
January 44, okay. What was the what was it like from the standpoint of the German air activity against England? Was it pretty well finished? I mean, they were, the Germans had no air superiority, so were you getting much of bombing and this kind of thing while you were there?
Yes, they had the buzz bomb.
Buzz bomb, okay, that's right. Yeah, they had the buzz bomb. Right.
You were okay as long as you heard it. So when it stopped, then you know it was going to fall somewhere.
Yeah.
So I, one time, had to get under the bed when I heard the thing stop. And then they came
up. Was it very loud? I mean, it was, you could hear it inside a building, for example, because you're going over there. And it was loud enough that you knew it was there.
Yeah.
And did any land near you, or mostly in the, I know they weren't very accurate.
No. And then they got the BE rocket. That was terrible because you couldn't hear. It came faster than sound. Oh, well, you'd be going that way and hits.
Were you near any of those hits any time?
Not too near.
But you knew they were.
Yeah, the only time I was near was in London, not too bad to pass or something. Because I was about 60 miles south of
Southwest. What was your, when you were on the 33 days, and when you're, well, let's look at Bastogne particularly. What were the conditions in Bastogne for people like yourself? I mean, did you have many food? I mean, did you have K rations, or you weren't resupplied there at all? So you were kind of running out of all materials, were you not?
Yeah. The matter of fact, the General McCollum told us to do anything to get clothing, anything to keep us warm, and anything to feed us.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd go into civilian houses and get blankets.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't there.
Well, the civilians were all gone, I think. They already escaped from Bastogne. They knew what was happening, and they didn't want to be there.
And what we had to eat for about 4 or 5 days was pancakes.
Pancakes? That's an odd thing to have to eat.
They found a store of flour or something.
Uh-huh.
And then we had pancakes for breakfast, for lunch, and for dinner.
And while you were in Bastogne during that time frame, what was your daily routine? What did they have you do? Or were you just kind of trying to stay out of harm's way, so to speak? And when the Germans started bombarding, you just kind of went for the safest place you could find, I suppose. That's interesting. From a standpoint of the people that you were with, did you ever have anybody that was maybe in your group or company that suffered what you might call severe psychological stress that really just kind of...
No. I don't think I ever heard of a paratrooper having that.
Because you were unusual people to begin with, I guess, chosen. Very specially to even get into that kind of a situation. Did you ever have occasion to have anybody come up the front lines in the way of the USO or the Red Cross or anybody that would ever come up on top of? Anybody, to entertain you, or
we had,
ever in a situation where that was even appropriate?
We had one USO, but that were, it was not the top headlines.
Uh-huh.
People I've never heard of, but it was very good.
Mm-hmm.
Red Cross gave us donuts when we were in a position to get them.
Now, how close did they get to the front line, so to speak? Were they
They got pretty close, I think, 10 to 12 miles.
Really? And they would have, would there be primarily men or women serving this, or who would?
Women.
Usually women. That was a pretty dangerous thing for them to do. What do you think about the movies that you've seen about, I guess you maybe saw Saving Private Ryan, I don't know. What do you think about that type of film and how accurate it might portray what you saw when you were?
I would say that Saving Private Ryan is the most accurate, but there was still some glitches in there.
Yeah.
Incidentally, Private Ryan was in my regiment.
Oh, no kidding. Now that's a very fascinating point. I know it was he was under another name, I'm sure, but is that right?
Yeah.
That's very interesting. I don't guess you ever knew anything about that event happening, did you? But from what you read, did you know that he was in your regiment? That's very interesting.
And of course, I have several books about the war,
uh-huh.
And one of them is called Look Out Below by a chaplain, uh-huh. Catholic chaplain. And in that, he mentioned the guy who people were looking for and taking back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. What do you think about your time that you spent in the service? Looking back, what's your opinion about what you did?
Positive. Most of all of it positive.
Why is it positive to you? What does it mean to you?
I feel honored to have been able to take part in it. Of course, when I was being discharged, they used to have a little thing that they sewed on the uniform we called a ruptured duck. And I had just had mine put on, and a sergeant came up, "You want to join the reserves?" And I said, "No."
This is an editor's note. End of tape A, side 2. The interview continues on tape B, side 1.
Wanted to join the reserves, okay?
I said, no. I said, hey, if I join the reserves, I have to wear this damn ruptured duck. He said, no, because you'll still be an airman. I said, sign me up. So as a result, I spent another 23 years in the reserve and got several promotions up to major and got a nice check every month.
Yeah, that's right. I know. That was a good thing to do. When you were in the reserves, were you, I take it you had 2 weeks active duty and all this business?
And the funny thing is, when I was in the reserves, I went up to the North Carolina Military District, and I was in Raleigh at that time. And I asked them where the closest airborne unit was. They said, Burlington. I said, sign me up. So every Thursday night, I would drive from Raleigh to Burlington for a 2-hour meeting. And then get home about 1 o'clock in the morning. But I still want to keep my airborne image.
Yeah, right. So that was the only airborne group that was within any reasonable distance.
And when I went to summer camp, there were about, I guess in my company, there were about 5 paratroopers, I think, qualified parachuters. And one day we were out there, and this guy, Sergeant 82nd, came up and how many paratroopers are here? Raise my hand. Said, would you like to make a jump? Well, everybody raised their hand except me. I said, hell, I'm going to do that too. So we got a little training and went up, made the jump. And when I hit the ground, I had a terrible landing. And a group of 82nd Airborne on the ground to assist us. One came over to me and said, Sergeant, are you all right? I said, yeah. Man, you ought to be dead.
When was this?
Fort Bragg.
This is, what year was this?
This was probably 1951.
82nd came up to help you, I'm sure as the 101st guy, you wouldn't want any help.
I don't know, we have a good relationship with 82nd. After all, they're veterans.
That's true. You are comrades in arms.
My best friend here in Clemens, we got to be close friends because he was a veteran. When I met him, he was working at the Goodwill trailer. And I went up there to get some of Richard's stuff, because everybody had gotten all the things they wanted. I still had a bunch. I went up there and I said, "What do you take?" He, in a very gruff voice, pointed to the sign and said, "This is what we don't take." And it was washing machines and stuff like that. So he came down. I said, it's very gruff. I said, "I got some of my son's stuff. Was killed in Panama, and the paratrooper and a ranger. He's turned into a pussycat. I'm a paratrooper too, and so am I." So we
hit it off
very much. And, he joins us for breakfast every Wednesday morning.
Do you have a group that paratroopers, basically, or
no,
just other?
He and I are paratroopers. One of the others was in a surgeon, but he wasn't in combat. And the other one was a hospital administrator, and he served an occupation in Japan.
I see.
But Bob and I had a very close relationship.
Yeah. Before we continue on and learn about what you did after the war, let me just ask you another question. How do you think future generations should view World War II? I mean, do you have any?
Oh, yes.
What do you think people should think about that?
I think they should think that that's the reason they're free. Mm-hmm. Because if we hadn't gone over to Germany, I mean, to Europe, England would have followed. France would have followed. Well, France had already followed. But I think we owe it. World War II is what started us. And a lot of people don't know that. I don't feel that. That's very true.
A couple other just general questions. Your leadership that you experienced during the war, how do you feel about the people that you were reporting to, your company commanders and
all very good except one.
Really? Without naming any names, what made him unsatisfactory?
He and I didn't get along.
Uh-huh.
He was not a college graduate.
Uh-huh.
And I would prepare things for his signature, and he wouldn't sign it because he said it wasn't right.
Uh-huh.
And unfortunately, I got credit for killing him. Because on D-Day, I finally got up with a friend of mine, and he came by with his clicker. And he was taking charge then, which is fine. He's a senior officer. We were in a hedgerow, and he heard something down at the end of the hedgerow, and he took off and said, "I'm not back in 10 minutes. That's when I told you he heard the commotion.
Yeah.
He was killed.
Yeah.
I did not get along with him because he was ignorant. My company commander, who was from East Tennessee Mountains, was a typical mountaineer.
Tough.
He was tough, but he was he relied on me because he didn't have any smarts. He took over when our company commander was captured. Mm-hmm. And every Sunday morning, or most every Sunday morning, I'd go up to the orderly room and go over the directives that had come down during the week and explain them to him, tell him what he had to do. Mm-hmm. Then I'd probably do something. And interesting.
Now, your company commander, he obviously had come up through the ranks, yeah. I take it. So, and he was, what, a second lieutenant, first lieutenant, captain, what was it?
First lieutenant, then a captain. Actually, he took CMTC in Tennessee. You ever heard of that?
No.
Citizens Military Training Corps. It was before the war.
I see.
And he was dumb.
But he was smart enough to know when to ask for help.
Yeah. an interesting thing. I went to Scotland, and coming back home on the train, I met this good-looking gal. Mm-hmm. I said, I'd want to stay a little longer with her, so I called her from London. I said, Gam, I called her somewhere else. I said, I'm in Northwood, England, and I can't get back tonight. I'll be there as soon as I can. All right, take your time. So me and this gal went to the bar, sitting there, tapped on my shoulder.
Told Tommy it was him.
Yes, it was. So he gave me company punishment. I couldn't leave the area for 2 weeks. That was on a Saturday night. And the next day we went to Jumping Hollow. That's all I know to survive 2 weeks.
What did you think about the enemy that you were facing? Did you develop an opinion of him and his capabilities and so forth?
They were very good. They had one fault. If their commander died or was injured, they were lost. And, you know, in the U.S., if the company commander killed, the next guy moves up and takes over. But the Germans, they just did. You can kill their leader and you got them. Mm-hmm. They're good soldiers, excellent soldiers.
Did you ever, were you ever in a position where you interacted with a captured German soldier?
No.
Never?
Yes, one time. In Holland, we captured a bunch of people. And we were next to a church where we had our company headquarters. Mm-hmm. And it was a big open space out there. And we captured some prisoners, and they were on the right hand as I was coming through. And all of a sudden, I heard somebody say, Tyndall. What the hell is that? But I don't know who it was, and he was next to me in college as a freshman. He was German, came over from Germany, and got his call to go back to military service. Mm-hmm. He said, I got to go to the bathroom. I said, pee in your pants.
Probably a lot of that done too, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Did you ever find yourself in a position where you were, you had to guide or lead any of our troops in some of their offensive activities? Did anybody, were you ever in a position like that where you had to be kind of a point man, you might say?
Only after the war, though. Uh-huh. That's, I must say, my unit was disbanded. Mm-hmm. And I went to 502. And I had been assistant supplier. Mm-hmm. And the lieutenant was in charge, Lieutenant Johnson. I interviewed with him, and he said, see, you were assistant supplier. I said, yes, sir. You want to be supply sergeant? Yes, sir. That was a great day for me because it got me promoted to staff sergeant. Mm-hmm. And I stayed there for the rest of the time. And after the war, I was in reserves, and I got all these directives because I was in charge of administration in the unit. Uh-huh. Came across one that said, if you were a first three grader in World War II, and had a college education, you could apply for commission. Mm-hmm. So I did, and I got it. Mm-hmm. And well, that was a great day for me.
Oh, yeah. You were struck by lightning. That was a great day. And that means a lot of difference in your, I'm sure, your retirement pay and everything else.
Yeah.
You talked about your company commander, the guy from Tennessee. So far as the other higher echelon commanders and so forth, most of them, I would guess, were probably academy grads and this kind of thing, were they not?
Not of a West Point, yeah.
Could you tell any difference between the West Pointers and those kinds of people versus the other people that you dealt with?
We had one who was the executive officer of our battalion. Mm-hmm. And he was strictly by the book. If the book said it, do it. If the book don't say it, don't do it. And on D-Day, the night, he and a group of friends of mine were captured. And my friend was telling me about it, that he had his hand blown off. And said he had a bandage on it and was sitting by a fire. And said, Major Gage was sitting over there doing like this. Read the wrong goddamn book.
When you were 33 days, particularly your 12 days and 33 days, were you in a position then where you frequently went without any food or water? I guess you had water, maybe, I don't know, some source, but what was your situation from a standpoint of your physical well-being? Were you able to stay well did you have any medical care or anything? Were any medics around that, or was it kind of just every man
for himself? Yeah.
And so far as your food, if you ran out, did the guys share their food, or what did they do? Every man for himself, huh? If you didn't have it, you didn't have anything to eat.
When we were in this attic, I made a friend I didn't know before. And all of a sudden, he said, look at that side. The guy was eating a candy bar. And we hadn't had any food for 2 days.
So that kind of tells the story.
Yeah. Right?
Not too much sharing going on. How about discipline in your group? People, if you were closest to, you know, your company, I guess. Was there any discipline problems? Everybody pretty much focused on what they were doing,
yeah.
And anybody AOL, AWOL, or anything of that nature.
Occasionally,
even in the front line situation, somebody would pick up.
No. But the only one that left like that was we had a mess sergeant named Sergeant PFAU. And he was from the south of France, come over to the United States. When we hit the beaches, or when the other people hit the beaches, that was the last time we ever saw him. We figured he took off for home.
He just was gone.
Gone.
And never heard anything about him again.
No. That's not even reported dead or reported missing, but not dead.
Discrimination that you were aware of in any of your, was there anybody that was discriminated against that you didn't respect, you might say, as a fellow soldier?
No.
Particularly due to any race, religion, or whatever? Yeah.
No, of course, at that time we had no
black men. Right.
I have a funny story about that when I was at Fort Benning for 2 weeks. Yeah. That's when we started jumping out the C-114s, which had two doors. And I went to the officers' club, and there were two black officers. They were talking about they made a jump that day. And one of them said, did you have to jump out the bastard door? What do you mean, they're both bastard doors?
Oh, my.
No, I didn't know any of that.
Yeah, right. What did you know about the progress of the war as you were doing your thing? Did you have occasion to read Stars and Stripes?
Occasionally.
That was, no. But they didn't deliver an issue to you.
No.
You got those back in the command post or whatever?
Yeah, we didn't hear a whole lot.
Uh-huh. So I guess that would mean your company commander probably, you don't know how much he knew, I'm sure, but anyway, he didn't pass it on if he did know it. What was the general morale of your unit?
High. Very high.
Was there anything that impacted morale particularly that you might remember, plus or minus, like mail call? Didn't get mail, and of course, many times you didn't get mail enough. Was there anything that impacted morale particularly that you recollect?
I think one thing is that in jump school, they have a psychological program that brainwashes you. For instance, we were told that we were better than any three men, and we believed it. Fortunately, I never had proof. Yes, morale was very high at Archer.
Did you ever have occasion to fight against the SS?
No.
As opposed to the general run-of-mill draftee in the German Army?
No.
I've heard some stories that they were kind of like our paratroopers. They
yeah.
never gave up and felt that they were worth three men, too. Well, before we go on to what happened after the war, how did the war change your life and your outlook on life?
Totally.
And you want to describe that any, or can you think of a way to put that?
Well, like in this little article, said I was 21, carefree, and didn't give a damn about anything when I went into the war. When I got out, I had a totally different outlook on life. When I went into the Army, I was engaged to be married. When I got out, I broke the engagement because I had a totally impact on my life that all my problems were little problems. And don't rush into anything. Yes, it totally changed my life. I became more looking at the everyday world, seeing how I could fit into it and do good. Learned before I could give back.
Yeah, it's named for that maturity, huh?
Yeah.
You really matured in a big, big way. I can certainly believe that after all that you saw. Well, let's continue on here. You got out of the service, came back to the U.S., and when did you actually get out then? And was that at Fort Benning, did you say?
No, at Fort Bragg.
Fort Bragg.
On the 17th.
Fort Bragg, you get out. And then what did you do when you got out?
Went home and loafed for a while. And then I worked with my father, who had a livestock company.
Uh-huh. In Kinston, I take it.
Yeah. And I told my mother I was going to wait and go back to school in the spring. If you wait, we'll never go back. So I went back January, Chapel Hill. And I noticed that my grades were much better after I went back. I flunked out twice. When I went back, I made an A. Mm-hmm.
Now, how much had you completed at this time?
About 2 years.
2 years. So you starting on your junior year, you might say. And then what did you major in? Oh.
Majored in business.
Business.
Yeah. I was going to go into my master's degree program.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my professors, Dr. Heer, said there was an opening at the highway department, and he sure would love to have me in that job.
Mm-hmm.
So I went and interviewed and got the job. So I didn't get the master's.
Oh, that was on the NC, North Carolina Highway Department?
Yeah.
And how long were you there, roughly?
There, about 3 years.
And then you decided to do what?
I decided to join Colgate Palm Olive Company and sell toilet articles.
Oh, okay.
And I did that for about a year and a half.
This was in about 49 or 50, something like that?
In the early 50s.
Uh-huh. And where were you living at that time?
Raleigh.
Raleigh.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you decided to do something else, I take it?
No, I didn't decide it. I was home going out the door when the phone rang. And it was my supervisor from Charlotte saying that they were laying off the last 50 people they had hired, and I was one of them. But they said, I'll pay you and give you 30 days' pay after you leave and help you any way they can. Mm. Well, I happened to know that placement officer over at Chapel Hill. I was in several things with him. And I walked in there and I said, Joe, I need a job. Hey, there's an opening in Plymouth, North Carolina for a hospital administrator. I said, Joe, I'll never make a damn hospital administrator. He said, well, out here at Memorial Hospital, we've got an open for collections office. I said, that's my speed. So I had an interview with Dr. Katniss that night at 6 o'clock in his office, which I knew where it was because my wife had worked there. Mm-hmm. And we went over there early to see some friends of ours cooking hamburgers and everybody drinking beer. I said, hell, give me one. I'm not going to get this job anyhow. When I walked in, and Dr. Cavins didn't get there until about 15 minutes after 6. He said, I'm sorry, Tim, I just been to a cocktail party. I said, thank goodness. And that's when I went to work in Chapel Hill.
And then how long were you there?
I was there until 1955.
And then you went?
Went to Wake Medical Center, Wake Raleigh, as assistant administrator.
And then? There, how many years roughly?
Oh, up there, I guess 4 or 5 years.
And then you went to
Fayetteville.
Fayetteville.
Stayed there 2 years, and it was worth 2 years of my life. They had the worst mold that I've ever dealt with.
You were the hospital administrator down there?
No, I was assistant.
Assistant.
Yeah. And the example of things that they would do, we decided to buy insurance for all the employees. And guess who got the contract with insurance? The board chairman.
Yeah, doesn't sound good.
And then one day, I had gone to Phoenix to a hospital meeting. And Mr. Broom, who was a banker, at the board meeting, said, I heard you went to Phoenix. Who authorized that? Mr. Brennan, the board authorized our plans for travel. And administration carries it out. He said, well, I don't think you should have gone to Phoenix. I said, the only thing I'm looking to do is Frank. He approved it as administrator.
Yeah.
And I finally decided we can't stand this. So I called the Duke Endowment, that's sort of a clearinghouse for jobs in the hospital field. And I happened to know the guy who was there. I need a job. I got to get out of Fayetteville. And so a couple of nights later, I got a call from John Deans. And I told him I was interested. And he said, well, can you come up here? I said, yeah, I was in Charlotte in a meeting. The next day I went up to Winston-Salem and talked to John, and he offered me the job. I said, yep, I'll take it. And I stayed there up until I retired. John retired.
And which hospital was that again?
Medical Park Hospital.
Medical Park, is that in Winston-Salem?
Yeah.
Yeah. Stayed there until William retired.
Yeah, it was a private surgical hospital. And then eventually Forsyth bought us. And in the meantime, I had signed a contract with Hospital Corporation of America, the managers, because we could get things so much cheaper. Well, down in 50 hospitals bought it. One small hospital,
yeah, right.
So when Forsyth bought us, and the administrator came over to talk to me, I said, could I stay on HCA's payroll for another 5 months? He said, why? I said, because if I do, I'll be eligible for that retirement. I agreed.
Oh, I was fortunate.
And I stayed there until June of 89. I enjoyed it very much. I had my own method of management. And it was to keep your employees happy and you'll have happy patients. And I don't necessarily mean money.
Yeah, all right.
But the way they're treated.
Yeah. There's a lot of truth in that.
And I was over there several years back getting radiation treatments for prostate cancer. And I'd gotten to know the two girls that were giving the treatments. One of them said, "You ever hear the Deming theory? And what do you think about it?" I said, "I've heard of it, but I don't pay much thought. It's a good on paper, but not in practice." I said, "I use the Tyndall theory." He said, "What's that?" I said, "Keep your employees happy, you're not happy paying."
A lot of truth on that.
Yeah.
Okay. What else you want to add, Earl, about your experience in World War II? Anything you can think of that might be? I think we covered it fairly well, or anything that we've left out that you want to add?
Fairly well. I think it changed my life forever. I was not that carefree again.
Yeah, right.
Because I knew there was more in the world than just myself.
Right.
Incidentally, when I was at Chapel Hill, he did work for me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is that right? That's very interesting. That's quite a coincidence that you wind up husband and wife.
Yeah, she called me in 1979, early 79, and said that she was in town for Miss North Carolina pageant. Her daughter was an interest. And I told her, "Well, you're just lucky to get me because I just came back from a Parents Without Partners meeting." And she said, "How is that organization?" I said, "It's very good. Why do you ask?" "Well, Fred and I have broken up." I said, "Well, how about having another with me?"
Well, on that note, I guess we'll conclude our interview with Mr. Earl Tyndall. And by the way, Earl and I are common grandfathers to Lee and Diane Tyndall. And of course, his son Don is married to my daughter Kathy. So it's been a pleasure being with you today, Earl. And sorry we don't get together more often.